Hello and welcome to episode 35 of the podcast we call Two Chairs Talking. My name is David Grigg and I'm joined by my co-host Perry Middlemiss as always. Hi Perry, how's things?
Good, thank you David, good.
We've been having an interesting time in Melbourne, haven't we? We're still in lockdown, we're still in stage 4 lockdown, we still have a curfew. And I don't know about you, but we also had to boil all our water over the weekend because there was a power outage. And we were told we had to boil water for several days to get around that.
I wasn't too bad. My water is provided by the same water provider as you, but my suburb area wasn't included into the water boiling warning, which is a good thing.
That's a good thing. Most things are okay, like, you know, having a cup of tea and so on, and boiling water to drink at the table sort of thing. But the worst thing, of course, is cleaning your teeth. You weren't allowed to use water out of the tap to clean your teeth with, so that was a bit awkward. But that was all right. We worked that out.
I'm okay, you see, because I was brought up in Adelaide. And Adelaide in the 1950s and 60s.
Oh, the water there was never
The water there was absolutely atrocious. The joke that I used to run when people used to say how bad the water was, I used to say, well, basically I didn't drink it, we just drank beer and we just stayed with Coopers and that was okay. And of course, when you think about it, they remember the idea of the small beer.
Yeah, that's what people used to drink in the 1800s, yeah.
Exactly right, because it was basically brewed substance in water and the bacteria just killed off everything.
Yeah.
The level of alcohol was very low and as long as you basically made sure as much as possible all of the utensils in which you brewed and then bottled were as clean as you could make them, then generally
it was safer to drink than
it was safer to drink that than it was to drink the water. So, that's right. I looked at it from the perspective as I'm doing the right thing by basically drinking beer all the time. luckily enough, we didn't have that problem, so we were able to get through that. But it's been a bit like the disaster bingo this year. We had that massive storm which caused the water purification problem, and we've still got 2 weeks of stage 4 lockdown to go. So it's just going on and on and on.
It is.
Actually, by our next episode in 2 weeks' time, theoretically, we should be out of stage 4 lockdown. And the number of cases is dropping quite markedly. We're now down into 2 digits per day when we were in the high 3 digits, over 700 a day at one point at the worst peak of this second wave. We're now down to 70-odd today. The number of deaths is still high.
Yes,
But most of those are in aged care facilities.
I have to say, though, we've sort of been joking a little bit around this COVID-19 pandemic, but one of those deaths, very sadly, was someone we knew quite well, John Bangsant, who was a real stalwart of Australian science fiction fandom for many, many years. And so we're very, very sorry to have lost him. But he did indeed die with COVID-19 a couple of weeks ago. So we're very sorry, and we extend our sympathies to his wife, Sally. I thought I might have a little bit of a talk about John and how he affected me, and I'm not sure, Perry, whether you'd like to add to that, but it really was due to John Bangsant that I became a science fiction fan. Looking back at it, the detail is that Kerry Hanfield dragged me along to John's place one afternoon, because John was having a sale of books. He was getting down on his finances and needed to sell some books. And so the excuse that Kerry had was that we'd go and see John Bangsant and buy some books and so on, which we did. But I met this character, John Bangsant, who I'd never met before and who was an extraordinary character. He would have been about 10, 11 years older than me. He was a very cultured person. It was really a revelation to me to meet someone like John, who really, really had enthusiasm for literature beyond science fiction, an enthusiasm for music, and was such an interesting, witty character that he really sort of drew you in, a very, a very warm sort of character. And one thing I thought I should mention is that just to give an indication of how well he was regarded in the science fiction community, there was a document put out in 1973, which requires a little bit of background to explain. John was a big enthusiast of John W. Campbell, and perhaps not politically correct these days with the Jeanette Ings speech and so on, but John was a real enthusiast for John W. Campbell. And he had a multi-year project to put out a publication called John W. Campbell, an Australian Tribute. And it became a little bit of a joke because it was taking him a long, long while to get this document out, this publication out. And in 1973, a bunch of us got together without John's knowing. And we put together a fanzine called John G. Bangsund, an Australian Tribute. And in there is no less than 25 testimonials really to John. It was compiled and produced by Lee Edmonds in 1973. And there's just this quite a thick little book. You know, it's got, 43 pages. And the 25 different people just giving their account of John, how John had affected their life and what he'd done in terms of science fiction fandom. It's delightful to go back over that and have a look at and see. But yeah, he's a great loss. He was a great stalwart of science fiction. It was due to John, really, that there was a push for Aussiecon in 1975. It was largely due to John that the guest of honour chosen for that convention was Ursula Le Guin. And so therefore, of course, that she came, gave a great speech. She ran a writer's workshop, which I attended. All of these things had a pretty big impact on my life. And so, yeah, it's very sad to see him go.
Yes, it was one of the major science fiction fanish figures to have been impacted by COVID. I first saw John, because I was living in Adelaide in the 70s, I first saw John at Aussiecon when he was on a number of panels, but he was also the Toastmaster at the Hugo Awards banquet.
Indeed.
And I always remember him sort of sitting there smoking away, because, of course, at that time you could smoke, and he did smoke. He had a drink in one hand, smoke in the other, listening to people and suddenly, oh, okay, oh. And then he had to hop up because it was his time to get up and sort of say something, so he did that. And he always looked a bit nonplussed and when he got up and sort of said something, but handled it really well, sat down, then did his bit. But it was just sort of this ongoing spiel all the way right through about how he was, you know, basically carrying on. And I tried to channel some of that when I was on my Duff trip to North America in 1996. And I was asked to present a couple of Fanish Hugo Awards. And I mentioned John Bangsund in that particular lead-in about how he looked like, every time he looked like, every time he hopped up, he looked like he was going to wet himself. And I said, standing in front of, I don't know, 6,000 or 7,000 people, I said, I now know exactly how he felt, and then just carried on. So I got a bit of a laugh. And but John, I met him in the later 70s, because he moved to Adelaide and he was there for a few years working for Rigby Publishers. And then he moved back to Melbourne, I believe, soon thereafter. Mm. I then moved off to Canberra and sort of lost a bit of track of him. But then I used to see him around the trap, saw him at you know, some of the conventions around. But he wasn't a big convention goer.
No, he was quite a shy person, I think. And in fact, towards the end of his life, he became a little bit of a recluse, I think. But although he was quite active, I understand, on Facebook, which I'm not a Facebook user, so I wasn't across that.
Yeah, he was there. Oh, he was there on Facebook, and that was how, for about the last 10 years of his life, I think that's probably about how he kept in contact with a lot of people. He didn't ever have jobs all the way right through, which were high paying, so he didn't have a lot of money left into his pension years or retirement years. But he was a very erudite character. Mm. I look on John Bangsund with John Foister and Merv Binns, let's say,
yes,
as being the three that kickstarted Melbourne fandom in the 1960s,
yep,
which led to, as you said, Aussiecon, but it on the way that introduced ANZAPA, the Australian and New Zealand Members of Publishing Association, which we're both members of, and which has now been running for 50 years, over 50 years. He, without John's initial kick, John Bankson's initial kick, and then John Foyster's energy and push behind the scenes as well, I don't believe they would have had AussieCon here.
No, I'm sure that's true.
And that would then have meant that we may have really struggled to have AussieCon 2 and AussieCons 3 and 4 as a result.
Indeed.
But, and so, yes, I can see very definitely, I think that both of us can, we can mark our periods to different degrees from John Bankson's activity in the field and the way that he introduced people, the way he wrote about science fiction and the way he wrote about fanish things, about fans and what they did, as opposed to, here's a book, let's just review it. It was also about, well, I went out to the park with some of my mates and have a barbecue and this is what we talked about. That's the type of thing that sort of helped drag me in as well, that feeling that there was this really warm, welcoming, erudite gentleman who was fun to have a conversation with.
Really was. We haven't even mentioned Australian Science Fiction Review, which ran for 3 years in the late 60s, which was a real seminal publication about taking science fiction seriously and criticising it seriously as a work, as works of literature. And so,
and without ASFR, as it was referred to, you wouldn't have had SF Commentary.
Well, that's right.
And
that's
therefore, and that's been now running for 50 years.
Sure.
And so there's this whole line all the way right through that John Bankson was involved in. He may not have pushed and prodded and got himself there, but just his presence and the fact that he'd tilled the ground beforehand allowed other people to come along later on and say, oh, okay, you can actually do this sort of thing. And just getting into it. And he was well known around the world, probably as a fanish writer, probably the best known Australian fanish writer.
Yes.
And probably the second one after that would be Gillespie.
Yeah.
So he was well known around the world.
Yeah, indeed, indeed.
He will be greatly missed.
He certainly will. Okay. All right, well, moving on a little bit, we decided that this episode we were going to look at the work of one particular director, or three films by one particular director, and that's Terry Gilliam of Monty Python fame, I suppose you'd have to say, but also has produced some great films, all of which have a slightly science fictional edge, which is probably one of the reasons we're interested in him. And so we thought we'd talk about three of those films. I certainly haven't seen all of his films. There's a lot of the later films that Gilliam directed I haven't seen. We thought we'd just cover these three, and maybe we can talk about some of the others at some later time. So a little bit of background on Terry Gilliam himself, I think, is probably worth going into first before we start talking about his movies. Gilliam was born in November 1940 in Minnesota, but spent his high school and college years in Los Angeles. He started out as an animator and cartoonist, but then joined up with Monty Python, and the rest, as they say, is his history. So do you want to kick off, Perry? Do you want to...
Yeah, the first one we wanted to talk about was Time Bandits, which is a film that he made in 1981. It follows the adventures of a young guy called, young boy, about 11 years old, called Kevin. Kevin's a bit of a dreamer. He loves reading about the ancient Greeks and spaceships and lots of science. He read lots. I mean, it struck me as soon as I saw him, I thought, oh, this is a classic geek. This could be me here. And so he's living in drab suburbia with his parents somewhere in England, and his parents are really mostly interested in crappy television programs and consumer goods, especially kitchen consumer goods.
Yes.
Because there's this really lovely joke right at the beginning about how there's an ad for something which will produce a meal in 13 seconds. And the mother says, oh, no, but that such and such are their neighbours, their friends. They've got somebody that can take a block of ice and turn it into beef bourguignon in 8 seconds. And you sort of think, oh, my God, how would you have this conversation? Anyway, so poor old Kevin goes off to bed one night and he's lying in bed staring at the ceiling, and he hears this rustling in his wardrobe, and suddenly this knight on horseback, armoured knight on horseback, bursts through his wardrobe, bounds around all over his bedroom, causing a lot of ructions, and then jumps through a picture or a painting on his wall and just rides off. Kevin gets up and has a look, and he thought the wardrobe was completely busted. Turns the light on, that's all okay. Looks at the picture, nothing there. Oh, okay. Wonder what that was. Next day. Well, I should also point out that he's basically been one of these kids that has always struggled to go to bed. So his parents are trying to force him off. Next night, he comes out and says, oh, I want to go to bed early tonight. And he takes his little Instamatic, you know, those Polaroid instant camera thingers where you basically take a photo and it basically produces the photo straight. You take a picture and a photo is produced straight away. He takes that to bed with him with his torch, on thinking that, well, the night's going to come back and you'll get a photo of him. Well, nothing much happens, and he falls asleep. And in the middle of the night, he's woken up by rustling again in his wardrobe. And this bunch of little people, dwarfs basically, burst through into his bedroom. He turns the light on, or turns his torch on, scares the hell out of all of them. And they all start wondering where the heck they are, because they don't know where they are. He doesn't know where they've come from. There's about six or seven of them. And suddenly the supreme being turns up, this big sort of glowing head turns up and starts yelling at these people to bring back the map that they've stolen from the supreme being. Well, they start pushing on the wall of his bedroom, and by this stage Kevin's up wondering what's going on. He's got his dressing gown on, and they push the wall down this long tunnel, which wasn't there before, and then push it out, and suddenly there's this big hole which they fall into. And after that, Kevin and these dwarves basically go on a rollicking adventure.
Yeah, it's a romp, isn't it? Yeah.
It's through different parts of time. And it comes out that these dwarves have stolen the Supreme Being's map of the universe. And as it's pointed out, things had to get done in a hurry when the universe was created. It was all done in 7 days, so things were a bit rushed. So there's a few little gaps here and there, which basically are little portal holes that you can, if you know where they are, you can jump through them and land somewhere else. And so what this gang is doing is they're trying to find the supreme prize, or the great prize that they're after. They don't know what it is, and they don't know where it is, and they just keep following the map, and Kevin follows them along. They go through different points where they end up with Robin Hood, who's played by John Cleese, Agamemnon, played by Sean Connery, and they finally decide that where they need to end up is at this place where the evil genius lives. Now, what a fantastic name. Don't give him a name, just say evil genius.
Yes.
And this is David Warner. This is the actor, not the cricketer, by the way. So. And so he chews it up.
He loves it.
Yes. Absolutely, is fantastic. And then later on, you find out that the Supreme Being, I won't give away the ending of this, but the Supreme Being turns up and is played by Ralph Richardson. And he's sort of this sort of diffident, well-dressed sort of character. You know, he's got all the power in the universe, but, it's all sort of laissez-faire about it all. And it's showing its age, this film, absolutely showing its age, but it was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed this. I thought it was just a good light romp, and I thought that it was really good. But by God, there's a lot of strange things that go on in this, David.
They
end up in a ship somewhere, and they're on this ship, and suddenly the ship, and they basically are. They get rid of everybody that's on, or the two people that are on the ship, one of them played by Peter Vaughan, who comes up in at least one of the other films that we're going to be talking about today. That's the other thing I should mention quickly, is that a lot of the actors that work with Terry Gilliam keep coming back.
Oh, yes.
all the way through. Not all of them, but some of the bit parts all over the place. And Peter Vaughan is one of these ones that does that. Anyway, they get booted off the boat, and Kevin and the dwarves are on the boat. And the boat starts to move, and then starts to rise up out of the water. And they find out that it's actually a hat sitting on a giant's head. I mean, a massive giant's head. You think, this guy, you know, very strange things go on inside Terry Gilliam's head.
Yeah.
But I thought it was an excellent little. I thought it was an excellent little film.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
It is a lot of fun. It's a classic. It's told from the child's point of view.
Yes.
But he's a very intelligent and mature child. In fact, he's much more mature than a lot of the guys that he's with.
Well, that's right. Yeah. But he also plays it as a very. What would you say? Very naive and very very believable as a young child.
Isn't
he? He's not trying to be anything that he's not. He's just a really a normal English school child picked out of the suburbs and placed in this extraordinary situation. So he's a lot of fun.
It is, and the interesting thing is, I looked him up, and he only was in one other film.
Yeah,
and that was it.
Yeah,
oh, well, and that was about three. That was about 3 or 4 years later. So I think it was. To the Lighthouse, which is would have been the film adaptation of the Virginia Woolf novel. So I think he was in that, and that's all. And maybe he just decided the acting life wasn't for him.
Yeah, well, that can happen with child actors. It does. Yeah.
It can do. But I thought he did pretty well in this. I thought it was great. But I think all the actors in this, a lot of the time, they're completely over the top. That's the other thing that you have to realise with Terry Gilliam. A lot of the acting is over the top, but a lot of the impact of the film comes from the way it's shot, how the camera is angled. And we'll talk about this a bit more later on in some of the other films that we talk about. Yeah. But he has some very... He uses a lot of close-ups of actors' faces talking to another character. But it's like this actor is right in your face when they're talking to you. And that can be a bit sort of, you know. But it's an impact that he's trying to make and trying to get across. I like this.
Yeah. It was a lot of fun. There's a few things I'd like to say about it. I think for a start, it's probably worth setting it in time compared to other movies that he was associated with. So Monty Python and the Holy Grail came out in 1981. So prior to that, Monty Python and the Holy Grail came out in 1975. He produced a film called Jabberwocky, which I think I've seen, but I can't recall it.
I think I've seen that.
Yeah, 1977. Don't think it was great. Life of Brian came out in 1979, so this is actually after The Life of Brian.
Okay.
Although I think for The Life of Brian, Terry Jones directed that. It wasn't a Gilliam film. But there's a couple of particular parts I'd like to focus on. Firstly, my wife was reading the newspaper the other day when it was Sean Connery's 90th, was it? Birthday. And there's a little piece in it about time bandits. And apparently in the original script, it just says, you know, this guy takes off his helmet and it's Sean Connery or someone perhaps cheaper. But anyway, Sean Connery took the part.
Well, this is the problem that Gilliam had all the way right through his career and has kept on having, is actually trying to be able to raise the money to be able to get these things made.
Yeah, but there's another couple of parts I'd like to mention because they're just brilliant. Ian Holm does this lovely little bit as Napoleon, who's obsessed with his height, with his size, and he gets very, very drunk. He's really, really likes all these dwarves who've turned up because they're smaller than him. But he gets very, very drunk. They get him drunk. And he's sitting there and he's talking about all the greats of history and he's thinking about their size. And he goes, Alexander the Great, 5 foot exactly. Isn't that incredible? Alexander the Great, whose empire stretched from India to Hungary, 1 inch shorter than me.
He's got this litany of historical characters that have done all these things in the past that are all of around about his height or a little bit higher. So it was really funny.
And the other great piece I thought was John Cleese, who's Robin Hood, and he greets the time bandits and Kevin, and he does this beautiful simulation of the British royalty carrying on just meaningless little conversation, you know. Yes, and how long have you been in the robbery business? You know, I say, and do you enjoy robbery?
Oh yeah, one of the guys says, "Oh, 5'2", and he said, "Oh, 5'2" is a long time to be in the robbery business."
That's right. And
he goes, "What?" Yeah. And then at the end, he walks off. So,
Yeah.
What a funny little bunch of men they are, and they just walks off. Sure. No, so nice little cameos here and there that sort of pop up.
Yeah.
Good stuff. Ian Holmes, excellent. And
He's always excellent.
And he only passed away just recently as well, so he's a great loss.
Yeah, that's true indeed. All right, so from Time Bandits, we might go on to talk about what I think is Terry Gilliam's masterpiece, really. I think it's certainly the best of his films that I've seen. And that's Brazil, which came out in 1985. Now, apparently this was originally going to come out. The original title he was going to give to this was 1984 and a half, which was a tribute both to the George Orwell novel and to Fellini's 8 and a half. I think the movie came out with Richard Burton and John Hurt. Film called 1984 came out in the year 1984, which is the year that Gilliam was trying to get Brazil out for. So he didn't use that name. So what can we say about Brazil? As I say, I think it's a brilliant film. But it's really set in a dystopian. If you look at the fact that he was trying to echo 1984, it really is in this dystopian future. But it's a very British dystopia, and it's really not a. It doesn't appear on the surface to be as dark as the book 1984 would be, and it's really this bureaucratic. A series of bureaucratic nightmares that Britain's become. And it starts off with the initiating incident for it is, what is it? Is it a Ministry of Information?
It's the Ministry of Information. Yeah. Truth will set you free is the motto.
That's right. So we start off with a scene in the Ministry of Information where there's a typewriter tapping away, automated typewriters. In fact, all the technology is this kind of really nice. It's almost like 1920s kind of technology in terms of the look of the typewriters and the look of the phones and that sort of thing. So it's set in the future, but it's all kind of creaky and this kind of 1920s kind of style of technology. And so there's all these machines typing things out on like teletype machines. And they're listing people to be investigated because they've done something wrong or they've got the wrong kind of thoughts or whatever. And there's a technician there and there's a fly buzzing around. This technician's trying to swat this fly because it's really annoying. And he finally swats it and it falls into the machine. And as the insect falls into the machine, it causes one of the keys to go wrong. And instead of typing Archibald Tuttle, it types Archibald Buttle as a person to be investigated. So the next scene we have is poor Mr. Buttle's home scenario in his flat with his wife and his children sitting there reading the paper. And suddenly overhead there's this noise and a hole starts to get cut in the floor above him. And this piece of the ceiling drops down. And out through the hole drop in all these guards, these security guards, armed guards, and they arrest this poor guy and they grab him and they put him in this kind of complete enclosed suit with his hands shackled and his feet shackled and carry him off, much to the protests of his wife. What has he done? He hasn't done anything. And this is observed by a young woman who lives in the flat upstairs who was in the flat where they cut the hole through and who's called Jill. And she gets really incensed by this and starts to try to get some justice done. Meanwhile, we've got Jonathan Pryce, who plays this character called Sam Lowry, who works for a government ministry. And we find out that he's been having dreams. We get into his dreams, and these dreams are generally of him flying with this incredible set of mechanical wings, wearing a beautiful sort of suit of armor, flying above the clouds, and he circling this figure, this beautiful woman figure with long blonde hair, it's sort of with a flowing robe, and he's coming to, you know, she's obviously his love object, and he's coming to try and get closer to her. And then he wakes up and he has to go off to the ministry, and he works in a department which is run by Ian Holm again, Mr. Kurtzman playing this kind of supposedly stern character, but in fact he's quite hopeless, and he really needs the Jonathan Pryce character who to help him out. Anyway, cut the long story short. Eventually, Sam Lowry gets to see this Jill character and realizes that she's the figure out of his dream. Because Sam Lowry gets this glimpse of this young woman character, he does everything he possibly can to try to figure out who she is and how he can meet up with her. And he gets to the point where he uses the help of his mother to join a different department, which is the Ministry of Information Retrieval. In that department, they're doing all sorts of really mean things. And we discover that the character played by Michael Palin, in fact, is kind of a professional torturer. And there's so many weird things in this film. He goes into this guy's office, and there's a secretary there who's transcribing what's going on in the next room, and the transcription is all no, please don't, it's transcribing this torture going on, and I'm doing a very bad job of explaining the plot of this movie. I should have done a better job, but it's full of this really, really bizarre sort of stuff. And poor old Sam Lowry eventually gets to the point where he does catch up with the Jill character, but she turns out to be quite a different sort of person than he expects her to be. And she's a truck driver, and he gets on board her truck and tries to tell her how much he loves her and how much he's really trying to connect with her. And she kind of just kicks him out of the truck at one stage, although he manages to climb back in. And he gets himself into more and more trouble with the authorities, and eventually comes to the point where he's in real strife. But there's also all these brilliant little cameo appearances of people. He has a problem with the air conditioning in his unit, in his little apartment, and he tries to get help through the bureaucratic system, and they tell him it's going to take months before anybody can come look at this. And while he's feeling bad about this, suddenly there's this knock on the door, and in comes this character all dressed with a mask and things and a gun, and sort of forces him back and starts to unscrew a panel in his wall. And it turns out to be Robert De Niro playing this character, Archibald Tuttle, who was the one who should have been caught by the authorities. And he's kind of like a, what would you call it, a freelance guerrilla
air conditioning
fixer. Yeah, that's right.
What a weird character. What a completely weird character.
And De Niro plays it brilliantly, of course. Yeah. And it's full of things like that. And as I say, I'm doing a bad job of explaining it, but I'll throw over to Perry, because he can tell you what he thinks of the movie.
Well, there's a lovely little cameo by Bob Hoskins as well.
Oh, Bob Hoskins, yes. He was one of the official air conditioning fixers.
And Ian Richardson does a bureaucratic manager who all he seems to do is wander around the halls of his department with everybody hanging off him and pushing bits of paper in front of him while he's striding down the halls. Just makes a decision, yes, we'll do that, no, get that, no, take that off, do that again, and just keeps on going with people just sort of drop it in front of him. It's like a bureaucratic nightmare, and it's just absolutely appalling. And you sort of think, I think I've worked in places like that, or it feels like I've worked in places like that.
Yeah. But it's not a funny film, is it?
There's
lots and lots of humour in it, but it's very, very dark.
Oh, it is. I was watching this, and I hadn't seen it for quite some time, and I was looking at it, and I think, there's a real noirish feel to this.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the lighting, the big shots of him walking down these very large corridors with huge pillars going up, and him walking along completely alone. And again, some of the shots that Gilliam makes in terms of the way he uses the camera to zero in, or to have somebody come around from the side of the camera and stick his face right in front of you and sort of basically say something. And it's very, very peculiar film. My wife and I watched it, and she said it's the most bizarre film she's seen in years. She can't remember seeing it before. I do remember seeing it before. I think I've seen it once before. It is a very strange film. It's certainly one of those ones that it's one that you need to see, I think. To have a look and see, just to see what can be done. I mean, a lot I saw a number of reflections, as you pointed out, of 1984. There's the Michael Palin's Torturer, which is a bit like the torture sequence in 1984. And in fact, he's taken into a very large area, which almost looks exactly the same as the 1984 torture area, which I would have to have a look at to go back and see whether that was the case. But there's just a lot of interesting little pieces that go on with this. It's a disturbing film in a lot of ways. Hard to work out why it was called Brazil, because Brazil is not mentioned in this film at all.
It's just the theme music.
That's all it is.
And that's why the word Brazil comes here.
I had to look it up, and it's the theme music was written in, 1939, and it's a Portuguese song, and they use that as the theme music. And
that's the name of the film.
As you said, they were going to call it 1984 and a half, or there was another one that's almost another title that they were going to use, which was almost a reflection of Dr. Strangelove, or How I Stop Worrying and Learn to Love the Bomb. It's sort of something along that sort of line as well. And I think he just struggled with a title, came up with that, and decided that was a good one. Well, it's as weird as the rest of the film, David. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. The other thing we should say about this, of course, is you've got to say which version do you watch, because I'm sure you and I both watched the version that Terry Gilliam originally produced, which is 2 hours and 22 minutes long, I think. But when he first tried to release it in the United States, the producers didn't like it at all and cut it down. I think they cut it down to 152 minutes. From 2 hours and 22 minutes, they insist on a happy ending, and I've actually seen that version. I actually owned for a while the Criterion Collection, which is several CDs about this whole thing, which includes a documentary where Gilliam talks about his hassles with this film. And the cinematic release in the States originally was this cut down version with a happy ending. He kind of escapes. He and Jill sort of escape into the sunset towards the end, and there's no torture scene in it. And this is just out of Wikipedia. A version of Brazil was created by the studio with a more consumer friendly ending, in other words, a happy ending. But they wouldn't actually release the film for quite a while, and so Gilliam took out a full page trade ad in Variety, urging them to release Brazil in its original intended version. And Gilliam actually conducted private screenings of Brazil without the studio's approval for film schools and local critics. And on the same night that Universal's award contender Out of Africa premiered in New York, Brazil was awarded the Los Angeles Film Critics Association Awards for Best Picture, Best Screenplay, and Best Director. And this finally prompted Universal to finally agree to release, a version of the film. But even that was still a cut down version. It wasn't until later that they released the full uncut version, which is what we get to see now.
Gilliam wrote the film with Tom Stoppard.
Yes.
So he's a major English playwright, probably best known for Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead.
Are Dead, yes, indeed. But a very well-known British playwright, yeah.
Yep.
And also the other contributor was Charles McEwan, who plays the character
Harvey Lime. Yeah, which is a bit of another pointer towards the noirish sort of style. Because as soon as I heard Harvey Lime, I thought, hang on, I've heard that name before. That's Harry Lyne from Third Man.
The Third Man, yeah.
Played by Orson Welles. And so there's another connection there.
It's good. He obviously likes having links to other movies.
There's probably heaps and heaps of things in these films that you've just skipped over. And unless you want to basically study them deeply, you're going to miss a lot of those little nuances that are there. But if you pick them up, they'll add a little bit more to the enjoyment.
Mm. Yeah, indeed.
I don't think you can get a good overview of Terry Gilliam's career without watching this particular film.
No.
But you can certainly understand why, post this film, he had a lot of trouble raising money.
Yes.
I would have think that there would have been a lot of producers that would have run a mile before coming anywhere near this particular thing. It might have picked up awards, but they weren't. It wasn't going to get big box office, and they weren't going to do anything, anything with it. And so it was then sometime later before, now there may be some films in the middle there, and there probably are. I think The Adventures of Baron Munchausen drops into the middle of it.
Yeah.
But in 1995, Gilliam directed and produced his most successful film to date, I believe. It did really quite well. And that's a film called 12 Monkeys. Now, he had trouble raising the money for this as well. His main actors being Bruce Willis and Brad Pitt. Pitt, I think, was probably only starting out around about this time, so he probably wasn't anywhere near as expensive as he would be now. But Bruce Willis was fairly well along in his career and was asking a fair amount of money, and Gilliam had to try to convince him to take a cut so that he could actually get this film made. Now, whether Willis came up with a give me, 1% of the gross or whatever it is, and we'll take it from that. But if he did, he would have done okay, because it probably got 3 or 4 times its budget back at the box office. So I think it probably did it did quite well. Now, this is a very interesting film from our current position, David, being in the middle of a pandemic where there's a virus around.
Yes.
Because this film starts in the year 2035, where you find out that the bulk of the human race has died in a pandemic from a virus. Everybody lives underground. And it starts off where we're in a prison somewhere, and a particular prisoner is volunteered, and that's in inverted commas, volunteered to go and do a reconnaissance mission out onto the surface. Now, the prisoner that's been volunteered here is played by Bruce Willis, James Cole. And he's put up to the surface. He goes around and has a look at a few things, finds what he's after is he's got to try and find insects, plants, anything that's growing. He sees a large bear off on one side. He sees a lion walking around a statue somewhere in the middle of this city, and goes back, takes the stuff back down to where he came from. And they're all very happy with what he's done. He's very resilient. He's basically been able to get all the stuff they need. And so they offer him the possibility of a pardon from his crime. Now, we don't know what his crime is. It doesn't really matter. But he's offered a pardon from his crime if he'll travel back in time and go back to a period before the virus was released and get information about how the virus did come to be released and who did it and who can possibly be to blame and what they can do about stopping it being released, if possible.
Although, no, I'm not sure that's quite right, having re-seen it just last night. What they don't think they can stop it happening. What they think is that if they can get some pure virus, they can go back to the future or to their present day and find a cure and solve their problem. But there's quite a thread throughout it which says, no, we can't actually change the way things were. That's fixed. So sorry to interrupt, but I think that's important to say. Yeah,
that's all right. And so basically, anyway, he gets sent back a time before the virus, but lands into the wrong time and lands in the year 1990, where the virus was going to be released in 1996, so the year or so after the film was made and released. Now, he ends up, and obviously everyone starts asking people questions about the virus, and everybody thinks that he's crazy. And he ends up being put into a lunatic asylum where he meets the Brad Pitt character. Now, this lunatic asylum is a total bloody mess. The paint's peeling off the walls, and it's a bit like the old Bedlam. They're basically all these people put together, not receiving any form of therapy at all. And he's basically kept in this place for a while, and then at one point it gets locked into a cell and completely tied up. But when the hospital staff go back in to see him, he's disappeared because he's been pulled back in time back to 2035. He goes back and gives a report, and they say, right, okay, fair enough. Well, we still need to basically get a bit more information about what's going on. And they try to send him back again, but send him back to the First World War.
Yes.
To the wrong place completely, where he ends up getting shot in the leg. And then whatever happens, he meets up with one of the other time traveller that's back there and actually has his photograph taken in the trenches of the Western Front. Then, whatever reason, zaps from the First World War back to up into 1996. Now, during his 1990 visit, he was being treated by a psychiatrist, Kathy Riley, I think her name is, who
played by Madeleine Stowe.
Yeah, played by Madeleine Stowe. He was being treated by her. He just completely disappears. Oh, also, one of the other characters that's floating around at the time, by the way, is a gentleman by the name of Frank Gorsham, who, if you know your stuff, played the Riddler in the early Batman TV series. So he was, as soon as I saw him, I thought, well, I've seen his face before, but he's been in very few things over the period. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. So basically, Willis Bace gets transported back to 1996, and he tracks down Riley and says, here I am. He tries to convince her that he now knows what caused this pandemic, this virus, to be released. And he believes that it was released by a group calling themselves the 12 Monkeys. And he comes to the conclusion after he tracks down, he sees the emblem being painted, how it's been painted on, graffitied on walls, follows the paint all the way through and gets into a theatre where he finds out that there are people there who are the army of the 12 Monkeys. And he also then finds out that the Brad Pitt character is the major person behind it all. Brad Pitt's father is a well-known Nobel Prize winning virologist, and Brad Pitt's got a real bad father-son issue and he's rebelling against his father. So Bruce Willis is of the view that the 12 Monkeys have released this particular virus and that he has to try and track down the Brad Pitt character and stop him from releasing it in order to allow his world in the future to not be in the problem that it's going to end up being in. So anyway, Willis basically goes through a number of adventures with Riley trying to figure out where Brad Pitt character is, to try and stop him from releasing the virus, to work out, and also to work out what's going on. It's more straightforward as a film than Brazil, but even so, I really don't believe that Terry Gilliam can tell a straightforward story. No. I just don't think that he can. It's just, it's got a lot of the similar sort of feel to this as for Brazil. You start, when you see three or four films by a particular director over a short period of time, you start seeing a lot of the commonalities that they have between one film and another. You start seeing those people, those ensemble of actors that are in the background that play the little bit parts, little cameos that are in one film and then pop up in another one and here and there. It's quite an interesting film. I enjoyed it. Don't know whether I'll go back and watch it again. I think I've watched it a couple of times over my journey now, and I think I'm done. So what was your feeling about it, David?
Look, I think it's a very good science fiction movie. It's probably worth saying that Gilliam didn't have a hand in writing this compared to the other two movies we talked about where he did have a very important role in writing it. It was written by Chris Marker and David Webb Peebles, wrote the screenplay for it. So it really, his role was that of a director, but it really is that look of his films and the kind of the feel of how each shot is taken is Gilliam's, and a lot of the weirdness. I mean, there's some really wacky things. Remember the bit where Bruce Willis gets sucked back into the future and he finds that all the scientists there are singing to him? They're kind of leaning in, singing this song to him to make him feel back, you know, because they discovered he likes music. They're back there, so that's interesting. The other thing we should say about this movie is that in fact it's based on a very short French film, only half an hour long, called Le Jeté, which I actually watched this morning. It's on available on YouTube. Which is really interesting because it's all done in still photographs, black and white photographs. with voiceover to it. But it's, that's where the concept comes from of this guy going back in time. And one thing which you which we need to point out about 12 Monkeys is it actually starts with looking at through the eyes of a very young boy who is seeing a very disturbing incident at an airport where someone gets shot, and a woman rushes up, you know, screaming that this man has been shot. And that's actually how the film opens. And the beautiful we're going to give away spoilers here, but the beautiful thing about this whole arc, and it comes out of La Jetée, is the child is actually viewing his own death because of this time travel loop. What he's seeing at that moment at the start of the film is actually the scene at the end of the film where the main character gets shot, and we sort of go back to see the child, and the child is, you know, does actually grow up to be that character. So he's seeing his own death, and that whole concept comes out of La Jetée. So that's really quite an interesting concept, but it's a lot more to the Gilliam film than just what's in La Jetée. But yeah, there's some really nice piece of that. But the whole time travel stuff is done very cleverly, I think, and you don't get to see too much of the actual traveling. I think there's only one point at which you actually sort of see him strapped into something and pushed through like a hole in the wall, and
shoved down a tube, basically. Yeah, isn't it? It's sort of scungy, isn't it? It's nothing.
Yeah, that's right.
There's nothing really pristine about it. This is not Time Tunnel or any of that sort of stuff where everything's scrubbed and everything's perfect. There's just crap everywhere, you know, and nothing's. The Willis character never seems to go to places which are pristine and clean. There's graffiti everywhere. There's posters all over the wall which are coming off. There's rubbish in the streets. And it's a pretty nasty place that he ends up going through all the time.
And I think the other clever concept of it is the idea that if you did have someone go back in time and start telling people that there's going to be this huge world pandemic, they are likely to be locked up as someone totally insane. And indeed, that's what happens to Willis. The first time he goes back, he's trying to tell people this is going to happen. But you know, you're nuts. And he's quite a violent character. And so he sort of bashes up a couple of policemen. They lock him away in this asylum. And the Madeleine Stowe character, who plays a psychiatrist, she's dealing with him very professionally, but she's very wary of him what he might do. And when he comes back the second time and sort of kidnaps her, I mean, she's absolutely terrified of this character who's, I mean, Willis is playing this, you know, you really can sort of believe that he is nuts, and that she certainly would believe that he's nuts. But the really lovely bit is where he comes back like for the third time, and he's now convinced that, in fact, she was right and that all of this is all an illusion, it's all in his mind. And he sits there with her, and she's now convinced, with all sorts of evidence, that he's absolutely right, and he actually is from the future. But he's sitting there saying, no, look, you've actually convinced me. I am insane, and you're quite right, and I'm going to have to work out how to get my head right again. And she's saying, no, you know, this is all really true. This really is going to happen. So it's this lovely reversal that happens. So that's nice. So, yeah, it's good. It's a very good film.
Hmm. And as I said, it was his most successful, earned a fair bit of money back, and probably made it easy for him to make films thereafter.
Yeah, sure. Hmm.
Which is good for him.
All right. Well, I think we've done Terry Gilliam for today. We've covered a fair bit of ground.
Okay, David, well, that does Terry Gilliam. We'll have to try and find another director at some stage and have a look at some of his or her films. Unfortunately, they're mostly his,
yes,
because there aren't very many female directors around, and not many in the SF field either, so that's a bit of a pity. But next episode, David, we're going to get back to books again, I believe.
Yes, yes.
And this time we're going to hark back to something that we spoke about, and I spoke with Chong about when Chong and I discussed the James Bradley, the latest James Bradley novel, Ghost Species. When we were talking about how a number of literary novels use science fiction tropes and topics, but are not labelled science fiction. Now, so these are some of the books that can be missed by science fiction readers and are worthy of their attention. So we thought we'd give some of our attention to some of those books, and that's what we're going to be talking about next time.
Sure. That sounds good. It would be interesting, I think.
Yes, hopefully. Yeah.
Indeed, indeed. All right, well, stay well, Perry, and keep on the mask, and you don't have to boil the water. I don't have to boil the water anymore, but yeah.
That's all gone. Okay, the mask is still there, but not while we're recording, David, otherwise it'll be...
Not while we're recording.
All right, okay, see you, David. See you next time.
Thanks very much. Bye.
Bye.